You're listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.
Listeners, joining us today on the Toil of Hell podcast is someone that maybe some of you might not be aware of, but you actually do know who this is. He is an actor. He's a podcast host. He's a pro wrestling commentator, pro wrestling referee, comedian, producer, record label owner, and now we could add a public speaker in Washington, D.C. to his resume, Mr. Kevin Gill. How's it going, Kevin?
What up, though? It's an honor to be here. I never thought it would be an honor to be in a toilet, but being in the toilet of hell takes it to a whole new level, and much love to you guys for having me on.
Sooner or later, we all end up in the toilet.
It's true.
Right. And then it's not about how many times you fall in the toilet. It's how many times you get out of the toilet of hell.
That is beautifully poetic in a weird sort of way. So let's start off with the big thing. I mean, you recently gave a pretty important speech in Washington, D.C. for the Juggalo rally. How'd you end up doing that?
Yeah, you know, it was a really an incredible honor and a true high mark in my life, my career, everything, you know, to stand on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, you know, a few feet from where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave his famous speech. And yeah, the historical significance and the First Amendment significance and et cetera are staggering to me. And it came about through, you know, I book wrestling for Insane Clown Posse's company, Juggalo Championship Wrestling. I also do the commentary with Shaggy Two Dope. And, you know, so I end up posting and doing different stuff for ICP and Psychopathic Records. So when they were putting together the lineups for the rally, they asked if I would speak, and I was honored to say yes. And then they also asked if I would host, and I'm like, absolutely. And then they're like, all right, you're going to be the first speaker. So I really wanted to try to put something down that meant something and just kind of speak from the heart. Like, I didn't know it was going to be simulcast on NBC and Fox and shown all over the world, but that only makes it better because I was speaking from the heart and I was trying to speak for people that needed to be spoken for, you know?
This was this was a really big event. I mean, it was kind of featured in media everywhere. Everybody on my Twitter, on my Facebook was talking about it, and the weekend that it finally happened, it showed that the Juggalo March was going on alongside some kind of MAGA rally, and that you guys had just completely dwarfed their event. They had maybe a couple dozen people, and there were thousands of Juggalos there standing strong. How did it feel to be out there in full force like that with solidarity between you?
To me, it was the most, well, I mean, the solidarity and the being out in force is something you kind of feel at every ICP show and at the gathering and whatever, but to take it outside of a concert, to take it to Washington, D.C., it felt like to me of all the different, you know, because a lot of people look down their nose at Insane Clown Posse and Juggalos and stuff, but in reality, what you're looking at is two guys from very humble beginnings, childhood friends, who went on to accomplish all of their dreams and provide inspiration and entertainment to millions while never like hurting anybody. You know what I mean? So it's a pretty amazing journey on their part, you know? And I don't know, man, just the whole thing to me was just like a really, really powerful thing. And that feeling was like no other, because it of all the things they've done and accomplished and organically created, like the last true subculture in America and all this stuff, it just felt like the biggest, most important thing that's ever happened in this world was that march, because of what it means for First Amendment rights, because of how many people watched it and are aware of it and will be influenced by it. It kind of puts the pressure on the government, and obviously they're under a lot of pressure because they seem to be fucking up more ways than there are things to do, you know?
Definitely.
But I think it put some pressure on them to kind of be like, hey, this is ridiculous. How can you say people who listen to a certain form of music are a gang, and how can you affect their livelihoods, their careers, their family lives, etc.? It's, to me, it's outrageous.
Definitely.
What do you think the next step is for Juggalos?
Well, the next step is, I believe it's October 11th. The ACLU and the Juggalo lawyer, Faris Haddad, along with Howard Hertz and all them, have been fighting diligently for years through the court systems. They're not suing for money. They're not suing for anything like that. They just want the gang report rescinded by the FBI, and they want like a statement of like these people are not a gang, so it stops affecting their lives, you know. But there's the appeal. It keeps being overruled by judges and being thrown out, even though there's grounds for an appeal. So coming up on October 11th, is the final appeal, and that's going down in Ohio. And it's going up in front of a judge that's either denied it before or has, it seems like will deny it. But the cool thing is, if that judge denies it, at that stage it gets elevated to the Supreme Court, which is kind of really where it needs to be anyway, because in my personal opinion, the smaller courts, if you will, the undercourts, kind of, they just want this to go away, so they're not giving it the time of day to have its proper day in court. However, this is what the Supreme Court is for, and that's where these ultimate type of First Amendment rights rulings should come down.
That would be amazing, seeing the ICP versus the FBI and on the docket of the Supreme Court.
Right?
It kind of this, as you mentioned, it was kind of the last subculture in America today. It brings to mind the way juggalos are maligned, similar to like the satanic panic of the 80s and 90s, and the media freak out over these kids who might be worshiping Satan and being involved in cult rituals. And of course, that's not the case for
anyone. And don't forget that the music that sold millions and millions of records in those days and was played on the radio and drew incredible live houses, that it was programming people to kill themselves. And you look at how much – it always comes down to money. That all that hullabaloo and bullshit about heavy metal music and satanic stuff and suicide and all that all led to what? Government watchdog groups and labeling, and it's all just money to pay to train people how to look for danger signs, people to go speak at universities and to police groups. And that's the same thing you see with the juggalo thing. Everything becomes a business. So, oh, there's a new gang. We need new funding. We need new training. We need new equipment. Oh, there's a speaker who'll travel around to police groups and give paid speeches and demonstrations. Well, we need that, and we have to spend our budget this year or we lose it. So it's all just kind of like a giant scam, just like comic books were on trial. Wonder Woman and Batman comics were on trial it was the 40s or 50s for causing juvenile delinquency and homosexuality. Think about how preposterous that is. But now Wonder Woman and Batman make money for Warner Brothers. You know what I mean? You're never going to hear anything bad about those characters in that regard because that's the thing. The juggalo world is not able to be co-opted. You know, you're not – the way – you could hear a Motorhead song on a Kia commercial or whatever, but you're never going to see Insane Clown Posse music or culture appropriated by mainstream corporations, i.e. they can't make money off it. Skateboarding was illegal until corporations found a way to make money off it. Tattooing, all these different things, you know what I'm saying? Even heroin was illegal until they changed its name to OxyContin, but I digress.
But I think that you definitely – you have it right there. What's always been so appealing about Insane Clown Posse to me is that it has been a truly DIY group, and it's grown from there with this DIY spirit of doing everything themselves, not having the outlets of the major labels or MTV or anyone to help out along. So it's
and that's an incredible thing. Like, look at how long ICP have been around and been doing their thing, and then think of how many other groups have been able to be successful for that long, and then slice up into how many groups are able to be around for that long without, as you said, the endorsements from major corporations and partnerships and all these other things. You know, when you see these other music festivals like Ozfest or whatever, or the Monster Energy Drink Festival, you know what I mean? Every stage and every surface is covered in corporate branding. And I'm not saying that's wrong. A lot of money changes hands for that stuff. On the flip side, when you go to the gathering, there is no sponsorship. You know what I mean? There's no sponsorship at any of these events. It's all 100% DIY. And I think that's what makes it so magical, that it's just from the imagination to execution, you know what I mean, with no one in between. It's a direct pipeline. And speaking of DIY, one quick note just that listeners may I love that you brought up DIY because I'm a big DIY person, and that's a huge part of what attracted me to the ICP world as well. But to me, the king of DIY was spotted at the Juggalo March. This is a true story, and it was photographed by my homie from Bayside, Queens, who was there shooting for the New York Daily News. But Ian Mackay from Minor Threat, Fugazi, Discord Records, he was there watching the Juggalo March. That to me is incredible.
That is truly awesome. I would like to believe that Ian is down with the clown.
Well, he's certainly down with, you know what I'm saying? Think of what he is down with. And he's a guy who's always held true to his morals, you know what I mean? Dee Snider also recorded some stuff for ICP for an upcoming track about this whole gang situation and et cetera, like a Psychopathic record cipher. But think about that. Dee Snider also, he doesn't just front, you know what I mean? He's a for real dude, and there's very few people that talk the talk. You know what I mean? A lot of people front one way, but they're only down when there's a paycheck. You know what I mean? There's very few people that do it from the heart. And those guys, all of them, ICP, Ian Mackay, and Dee Snider, are all those type of dudes.
Yeah, I mean, I've watched videos of Dee facing down the PMRC committee and Tipper Gore back in the early 90s. It's he's been a champion for artists, definitely.
For real.
One of the things that I really liked about your speech in D.C., other than people chanting "you fucked up," which was sent to, you know, through CBS and NBC. All
yeah, that was hilarious.
One of the things I liked was just your message of positivity. And I know you're into PMA. How did you get into that?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. PMA for me is I first discovered it on a Leeway record. Leeway is this criminally underknown but mind-blowingly incredible New York hardcore band, and I had first heard it on there, and on their Born to Expire album, and they were just saying it, they had heard it from the Bad Brains, you know what I mean? So I kind of went back then to the legendary Bad Brains, and they really put the message out in the punk rock and hardcore world. You know, they had got it from Napoleon Hill, the author of the book Think and Grow Rich, that was written in like the 20s. And they just brought that positive mental attitude combined with their like Rastafarian roots, hardcore punk rock glory. Then from there, like people like Leeway, and then in the 90s, H2O, another groundbreaking New York hardcore band, punk rock, whatever. They really ran with it, especially Toby Morse. And then you had guys like John Joseph from the Cro-Mags. So being a New York hardcore guy and being around these people and, you know, hearing it in the music and believing in the concept, it was always just kind of there, like, oh, keep that PMA, you know what I mean? Or, oh, I got that PMA, you know? And then just as time went on, it became more and more of like a driving force, because I realized almost everything I've been able to accomplish in life is kind of through that concept, you know what I mean? I was a dude that just with no connections, no hookups, no special discernible skills, that was super interested in video games, music, and wrestling. And I got to work at Rockstar Games and Eidos Interactive and places like that. I got to make some wrestling video games. I got to put out a ton of hardcore records, tour the world fronting a band, tour the world with or around the U.S. at least with my homies ICP, do wrestling commentary, book shows. Like, and it's all just through that, you know, this, as Violent J always says to me, ain't nothing to it but to do it, you know, and that. I later learned, like, to me, what PMA is to me, it all kind of combines to, obviously, it's a positive mental attitude and picking yourself back up and pushing forward and not getting mired down in negativity. And nowadays, so many people use the internet for exclusively negative purposes, or the idea that somehow being a troll is something that people aspire to or aim for or credit themselves, like, LOL, I'm a troll. It's just such a sad, unfulfilling, miserable, negative, like bitter life. It's so much better if you focus on the things you like, you know? And if you focus on the things you like and work towards them in tangible ways, then you find yourself there. It's great to buy a ticket. It's great to sit in the audience. It's great to see a show. I do it all the time. But if you want to be more than that, you have to have some kind of tangible output. You know, for me, it started with putting out records. Putting out records got me video game jobs. Putting out video games got me all kinds of other gigs, and, you know, including voice acting and all this stuff. And then it just keeps rolling. Then, you know what I mean? But it all comes back to tangible output. You can't just be like, I like it. Everyone likes it. You have to put something out there. You know what I mean? And PMA to me is like it's like GPS for destiny. You know what I mean? If you just keep a positive attitude, be a good person, work hard, and move towards your goals, though, that's a really important part. And just cut away. Sometimes it's hard to do, but you have this negative festering person in your life that every day is just a 45-minute list of complaints. And if you can't change them, you have to kind of mute them or leave them in the background or out altogether.
Do you have any sort of mantra or ritual or even a saying to help you keep the positive mental attitude? Like, I've used, like, I've made it this far. Like, sometimes I need to repeat that in my head to stay positive. Do you have anything like that?
No, that's a really good point. I should try some mantras. I just try to just always, in my mind, I guess, I don't actually say it, but it's something I always think about, is like, pull the camera back. You know what I mean? Like, if you pull the camera up to a bird's eye view, like, look at the whole picture. You know what I mean? Or what's the best way to deal with this? Like, I'm always focused on the goal. So the hurt, I always look at it this way. A lot of people get completely dead stopped by their first hurdle. And what I've learned from working on all these different projects, from, you know, $100 budgets to, you know, millions of dollar budgets, is that it's not about the hurdle. The only thing that matters is how you got around it, over it, through it, underneath it. And every project and everything you do is going to be full of hurdles. You're not defined by the hurdle. You're only defined by your ability to counter-navigate it, you know?
I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned it just a minute ago, you worked in video games for a while, specifically on wrestling games. Was it backyard wrestling that you worked on?
Yeah, Backyard Wrestling 1 and 2 was an idea I had for a video game.
I played the fucking shit out of those games. I loved those games. So that is incredible. Number one, like, it was fun. Number two, the soundtrack to them was also just so great.
That was by me. That was my work, my friend. I'm so proud of that shit. I can't front.
I think that was the first time I heard Insane Clown Posse, and like a whole bunch of stuff too. Like I feel like Sepultura was on there, and like E-Town Concrete was on there too.
Yeah, E-Town Concrete, Anthrax, Sick of It All, bands that really broke big later, like Yellow Card, Andrew WK. I don't know if I said Rancid already. Bad Brains, Gorilla Biscuits. Think about that, dude. Like, the Gorilla Biscuits, first time ever in a video game is Backyard Wrestling. KRS-One, first time ever in a video game. And there was something like over 60 songs, and they're all just – sometimes I look at the list and I'm like, what? No way. Like, I forget even some of them. But that and the 25 to Life soundtrack are two of my proudest accomplishments. Like, just going through all this music and just finding the songs that perfectly Dropkick Murphys are on the Backyard Wrestling soundtrack. I'm sorry, more bands keep popping into my head. Gwar. I could go on and on.
that was, I think, you know, as a young music fan that was super into video games at the time, like that Backyard Wrestling and the Tony Hawk Pro Skater games, they introduced me to so many cool new bands that I wouldn't have ever heard otherwise. And it was just... a really great experience for a 12-year-old boy.
Oh, well, I'm proud, man. I wanted to give people a whole array of music, of sounds, of different cultures and vibes. You know, there was electronic music on there, you know, hardcore punk rock, thrash, straight up rock. And you know how it is. A lot of video game soundtracks are so corporate or boiled down, and or there's no one in the loop that really understands the genre. They're just... Like, I partnered up with certain labels, but it was open-ended where I could work with anybody. But instead of just taking, you know, some people, it's like, oh, wow, what, they just get the beginner's class records from this big label instead of getting, like, the hottest artists or the artists you knew were going to blow up, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I you know, rarely buy a Madden game, but, you know, in the past, I'm like, why is this track on here? Why am I listening to this right now?
Yeah, you know, 100%, or it's stuff that's being pushed, not stuff that is tone appropriate or feels right. With the Backyard Wrestling stuff, I really felt that everything in there, like if it was an electronic track, it's aggressive. If it was a hip-hop track, it had an edge to it. Everything had to fit those parameters, and some artists were well-known or had a good track, but it didn't feel right for the game. And I think stuff like that is a step that a lot of people don't bother to take, but I would play the game with all the different music in it just to feel what was working and what wasn't, you know?
Absolutely. And it shows. If anything needs a resurgence for, you know, the new Xbox, I want to have Backyard Wrestling updated.
Hey, here's a few. I'm just looking at a few of the bands here of Backyard Wrestling. Let's see. On the first one, Andrew WK, Anthrax, Biohazard, Bowling for Soup, CKY, Chimera, Dropkick Murphys, E-Town, Further Seems Forever, Insane Clown Posse, Mingan FS, Cool Keith, Neck, Rancid, Sepultura, Shadows Fall, Sum 41, The Rise, and more. That, to me, that's a pretty dope soundtrack. And I know we went even further on the second one.
Yeah, absolutely. And this was the super early 2000s too, so it was a lot of stuff that was like just getting out at the time. Very cool stuff. But you've had a connection with wrestling, and especially independent wrestling for a long time. You became the referee of Juggalo Championship Wrestling. You talk about wrestling with wrestlers. I believe that's how Jordan got to know you.
We're in a super cool exclusive group on Facebook that just talks about wrestling.
Yeah, like it's exactly. It's super cool, super private, and that's the best way to describe it. Shout out to Big Dave.
Nerds, keep out. You're not welcome.
You must bow down to Dave Bautista before you get into the group.
No homers.
So, when did you first fall in love with wrestling?
Oh, just like a lot of people, man. Like for me, it just when I was a kid. You know, like growing up in New York. I grew up in Queens, New York, and wrestling at the Garden was something that would happen every month, and you know, it was on TV and stuff. And when you'd go to the store, there'd be like, you know, 12 or 15 or more magazine facings, like on the rack of just bloody faces. And it was something you were aware of as a kid, but it wasn't something that I was like, oh, I'm going to watch wrestling, you know, but then I would always hear people talking about it and stuff. And finally I just watched it one day and was like, man, this is amazing. And I was just hooked from then on. And once in a while I was able to go to Madison Square Garden to see like house shows and things like that. And I just loved it, and then stayed a fan until it kind of like there got to be like this dark period in wrestling before like the ECW boom of like 96. The years prior to that were kind of like creatively bankrupt and just bad years for wrestling. It kind of like almost killed the business, as they say. And I was like putting out records and stuff, so I was like more into, you know, doing other things. And but then, like, the buzz of ECW got me back into wrestling, you know what I mean? And then because I was working with my label, Striving for Togetherness Records, I was working with different magazines and stuff. So a magazine called Cord out of Philly and later called All That, they had me start doing wrestling interviews for them. And I interviewed, like, Freddie Blassie and Too Cold Scorpio and Bill Alfonso and a couple other people. Just like kind of, you know, shoot style interviews for the magazine. And that was just a really cool opportunity. And then ECW got me back into wrestling, like in the biggest way possible. And it kind of fueled, and that was right around the same time that I discovered Insane Clown Posse through Stranglemania. So, it was a year or two after that, discovering all those things, ECW and ICP, I got a job at Rockstar Games, which came down to one signature short of actually doing the first ECW video game was to be done at Rockstar Games as part of a deal that I helped put together, which was incredible to do and to bring the entire Rockstar team down to the ECW arena to bring them. Well, I mean, I've seen it a million times, but for them to see their first show, to go have meetings with Paul Heyman and stuff like that, was incredible. And, but in the end, for a myriad of reasons, Rockstar, we know ECW fell on some hard times business-wise and stuff. And then in the end, there was issues with Acclaim and lawsuits over ECW and loans. We had nothing to do with that because we, at the zero hour, we opted not to sign the agreement, like at the Rockstar executive level. But it had all been negotiated and was countersigned on the other side. So a little while later, I was getting tired of the grind at Rockstar because it was just working 24/7 all the time. And I had shipped a ton of games. So I was like, I felt like I had my legs under me, you know? And I got offered a job to go to Eidos in San Francisco. And my first meeting there, I brought up the idea for a backyard wrestling game. And like a week or two later, we had like an internal deal memo and it was in production. You know, we started pre-production on it. Right away. So for the first several years that I was there, all I did was work on, I had a few other projects like to roll with, like Hitman and things like that. But then I worked exclusively on those games for a good long clip. And that's like the super hybrid story. And then basically working on those games led to knowing wrestlers a lot better and, you know, dealing with them and booking them and putting together events with them wrestling on them. And that led to ICP, in their opinion, they stated that they felt I was very knowledgeable about wrestling and more knowledgeable than anyone they ever knew. And these guys, meanwhile, are like scientists of wrestling. So I'm like, shit. So they started using me as a referee, which was like a great honor. And I kind of got trained a bit by Vampiro and Man Man Pondo and the ICP guys. And I then got to ref literally all over the entire country. And I also refed extensively on like the California Independence as well at that same time. And then the guys heard me doing commentary on a DVD, a memorial DVD for DJ Riz. The ICP guys heard it and they were like, boom, we found our new commentator. And then I started doing, then I kind of phased out of refing and just been doing commentary ever since. And just this past week, I got to call a match for a Ring of Honor's Future of Honor series when they were doing their tapings in Las Vegas. And I just got to do Triple Mania. So I feel like I've been getting a lot of incredible opportunities. And I'm really grateful to all the people that, you know what I mean, that support and believe in KG, you know what I mean, from Toilet of Hell on up to wherever.
Let me ask you a question about reffing professional wrestling, if you don't mind. Why don't refs occasionally look behind their back? I feel like they're missing so much.
Yeah, you know, on the real, like, I'm not a huge fan at all of people relying endlessly on the tired referee can't see that the other guy, the bad guys are cheating and the good guy desperately wants to make the tag, but you know what I mean? The ref keeps being, good guy, it's not your time to be in the ring. Sometimes I think you got to be more creative. Like, even though that's a obviously it's a classic spot, but it's not the only way. I like innovative stuff. So I think there's innovative ways. The ref, with or without having like a, you know, a part like that and having a pivotal role as far as the viewer sees, the ref has a really important role in the match period. But then if you're going to give them an additional role or responsibility or performance aspect or whatever, I think it should just be innovative. You know what I mean? Because like you said, it's kind of like sometimes someone has to be counted out for a count out to mean anything. You know what I mean? Or someone has to be disqualified or sometimes, you know what I mean?
Definitely. Definitely.
You have to enforce the rules.
Right. Otherwise they don't exist. Just, and you know how it is. If no one ever gets counted out for like 10 years and then suddenly you do a count out finish on the pay-per-view, that's bullshit. You know what I mean?
Very true. Very true.
It's funny listening to your fandom origin story because it's very similar to mine, except I was in Brooklyn instead of Queens.
Oh, nice. So you know what I'm talking about. Like, wrestling is just part of it. Like, the results would be in the newspaper.
Yeah.
You know?
Was it the Slammer was the writer who had put it in?
Yeah,
the
with game? That mask.
Yeah, I used to go to MSG, too, for house shows all the time.
Man, it's just incredible. And Madison Square Garden, you know what I mean, is to me, I know it's just a giant arena, but, and part of it is since you're a kid having it drilled into your head, like, oh, this is the mecca of pro wrestling. This is the, but it kind of like felt like it always lived up to that. And the crowd is super hype, you know?
Yeah, they used to have major events there all the time, and now they don't really do it anymore because apparently it's difficult to film there for like pay-per-views. So they just have house shows there.
Right, right. Yeah, I guess the rent is like bananas and it's probably all like, you know what I mean? Like the sometimes producing that type of event at a union shop can be really costly, super costly, you know?
So you have your own podcast, The Kevin Gill Show, where you talk to wrestlers as well as musicians, you know, like you've had the Cro-Mags on, you've had Soulfly on. Is there any particular person you've interviewed that like people that listen to our show should really check out on their own?
Man, like on the wrestling tip or on the music tip?
Both.
On the wrestling tip, I would say I did a 3-part in-person interview with Sean X-Pac Waltman that I think is incredible. There's a 2-part one that's like so in-depth and so personal with Paul London, you know, from Lucha Underground, formerly of WWE, who's literally like a brilliant creative mind and a super articulate person. And he shares his story and his life in a way that's incredibly moving. I also have a 2-parter with MVP, like, you know, super in depth. That's just really cool. And I think the whole recording in person gives it like a whole extra, besides the sound, it also just, it allows a connection of conversation to happen. That's like something special. And on the music tip, man, I think I have a really good one with Violent J from Insane Clown Posse. There's 2 different ones with John Joseph from the Cro-Mags that's pretty incredible. The Lars Fredriksson one from Rancid is like 90% about wrestling, which is awesome. Who else, man? There's so many. I'm really proud of a lot of them, man. The Young Bucks one is great. Recently, people were really loving the one I did with Melina. There's one with Kevin Lyman, the founder of the Vans Warped Tour. I try to really do quality control. You know what I mean? I try to really seek out guests that have that vibe that you know are just going to deliver the real. You know what I mean? There's a lot of people that are, you know what I mean, that don't really talk for real. And to me, then you know, what do you get? Oh, the boogeyman. Please don't let me forget the boogeyman. Two parts with him, like out of character and so in-depth and so personal. Yeah, it's something special. And the John Morrison episodes, I could literally just go on. Now I'm looking at them.
Shelly Martinez on a couple times, and she's my diva crush. And I actually got to speak with her a few years ago at a convention, just not about wrestling, just a regular conversation. It was great. So I really enjoyed listening to those as well.
Oh, man. Thank you, brother. Yeah, Shelly's one of my favorites. She's so high energy and so awesome. Yeah, it's been an honor to have her on a few times. You know, the Chris Hero episodes are great, too. I don't know. I feel like if you just scroll through, everyone will find something that they like.
Do you have a white whale for the show, like someone you really want to get on the show that you haven't been able to yet?
Paul Heyman.
Oh, yeah.
That'd
be amazing.
That's my number one. But if I was making a dream list, a very short dream list would include Paul Heyman, Axl Rose, Chuck D, KRS-One.
Man, that Axl Rose. I feel like you'd have an easier time getting Jesus on the show than Axl Rose. He's he's notoriously a little difficult to deal with.
Yeah, he's just so awesome, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, I think he's just awesome. But yeah, that's part of his whole mystique, you know, I guess. Or he's an asshole. But either way, I enjoy his histrionics.
So you put out a release from 25 to Life when you were running your record label in the 90s. How did you get involved?
Their debut record.
How did you get involved with Rick?
I was really into music ever since I was a little kid. Like, I think it was just like an escape for me or something. I just really was fascinated with music. Any music I could get from like parody records, like joke records and stuff, just anything. I was like Christmas records at the seasonal, you know, whatever I could listen to. I would the radio, taping shit off the radio. And then I started hearing like heavier music for the first time and was like, whoa, this is fucking cool. This is more real. Like, I like this a lot. And then some people turned me on to New York hardcore type stuff. And I went down to CBGB's and saw Sick of It All at a hardcore matinee and was like, holy fuck. You know what I mean? So from that minute on, I was just hooked on hardcore, you know. And then it's like, you know, your friends will be like, oh, if you like Sick of It All, this is Agnostic Front. Now check out this. And I was working for a little while at a Relativity Records, or Important Record Distributors, as it was known as well, in Hollis, Queens. And we distributed a lot of all the top records. So like, you know, straight up, I would just take a Gorilla Biscuits record home from work. And I always remember taking it home. Like, I moved out of my house at a young age and like just wanted to do my thing. You know what I mean? So I came home from work and put on that Gorilla Biscuits record and just sat and read the lyrics and was like, start today, you know. And I was like, man, this is the most incredible thing ever. Like, it's as real as it can get. It's not as abrasive, even though I love the abrasive stuff like Sick of It All and all that. Like, I love it. But the melody and the super positivity of the Gorilla Biscuits, and the fact that they could mention like playing Donkey Kong and stuff not in a way that's like a cheesy plug like The Offspring or something, you know what I mean? Like, it just connected with me in a big way. So I was then super into hardcore, and I would, you know, buy fanzines and go to all the shows and order independent records and just literally like hardcore kid, you know? And then you start going to underground shows and stuff. And then I would just see bands or hear of bands, even sometimes as they were forming, you know, and I'd be there in these little rooms like Bond Street Cafe and be like, wow, this 25 to Life band, they've played like 6 shows in the last 2 weeks, like for all the major, major bands. It's that crazy guy, you know, we used to call him Jesus. I mean, just me and my girl, because he had like the super long ponytail. He didn't even have the dreads when he was first around. And then it's like, oh, it's that guy, and he's got these people. But then you just go to the shows, everyone's losing their mind, and it's like, these guys need to be in the studio recording songs. And it just became – it's like I talked about putting shit out there into the world. So right then I was like, all right, well, how much does it cost to record? You know what I mean? What's a good studio to record at? How does pressing records work? And then, okay, well, I'm going to need a better job so that I have more money to put out records. And that's what I did. I was able to get a better job. And then I used a lot of the resources at my job and the money I earned to put out a whole string of records.
That is awesome. That is
so. It was that, and that's something I prided us on. Was for almost every band we worked with, it was their debut record, and that to me, that's the magic. Vision of Disorder, 25 to Life, Shutdown, Fahrenheit 451, No Redeeming Social Value had done albums before, as had Six and Violence, but Neck had not. There was a you know what I'm saying? Just so many bands. It's just such a cool thing. And even to this day, sometimes people will recognize me from the New York Hardcore documentary, like in totally random places, or like a person checking. I'll be in some random state or city and going to a show or an event, and the person checking my ID will do like a double take and be like, SFT Records? And I'm always like, that's so dope. You know what I mean? So, yeah, those are just, like, fond-ass memories. But, yeah, it was a matter of just loving and connecting and identifying with the music super strongly, and then being around the people and getting to know them, and then being like, there's this vital piece missing. And the piece is someone to put these records out and someone to know, like, okay, of these 10 bands right now, who's the one that's actually going to not break up tomorrow? Who's got the most upside? Who's the best, you know? And sometimes it was really hard, man. The hardest decision I ever had to make – or at least as far as picking a band to sign, at the exact same time, Shutdown and Indecision were both just burning up, this, you know, doing really well on their own out of Brooklyn. And I was like, man, both these bands. And I just straight up did not have – and we were putting more money into promoting records at that time than ever. So I didn't have the money to do for both records what we were going to do for one of the records. You know what I mean? And I didn't want to like, oh, let's do half as much stuff for one and sign both. You know what I mean? I was like, we got to just pick one and run with it. And it literally was so hard to do. And we chose Shutdown. And obviously I'm happy with Shutdown. They're great. But I so wish we had the money and or all these other people now who have all these deals. And, you know, we had no P&D deal. We had no advances from anybody. We had nothing. We tried to get deals with other labels and companies who would offer us like embarrassing, like where you're like, are you kidding me? Like you've talked to me and taken me out to dinner 10 times to come at me with this. Like if you even would have hinted at this, I would have just said, oh, no, thanks. You know what I mean? like, you know what I'm saying? I always make it out to be like, if I spent like 10 different times with you outlining what we were going to produce as far as a live concert event. And then the night of the event, I'm like, all right, here we go. It's going to be my iPod connected up to an auxiliary cord. And then you're like, why did we discuss lighting rigs and headliners? And you know what I'm saying? Like, why do we outline an entire house if you know you can't offer anything more than a shed, you know? So, yeah, so that was how it all worked, man. But I'm proud of it, man. It felt amazing. Just and at first, the stores wouldn't even take the records. I used to go personally from store to store in the East Village and everywhere trying to get our records on the shelves, and a lot of places wouldn't even take them. And you had to, like, work with Bleaker Bob and stuff, who was like a bully-type asshole. But, yeah, and then by the end, it was like you couldn't print them fast enough, but then it becomes hard to sustain, like ECW, because you always have to be putting out money to record bands, to press stuff, to make merch, to do all these things, and then at the same time, you're waiting and waiting and waiting for the people to pay you for the large orders that they did. And sometimes you had to hold up records, like you're not getting the new record until you pay me, you know what I mean? And then it's all kinds of threats and drama, and then they finally pay you, and it's like, why are you doing this? Like, you make money, I make money, or I get my money back to make more records, you know? Like, let's just do it. What are you fucking me around for, you know?
What do you think was the most important lesson you took away from running your label business?
I mean, what I got from Striving for Togetherness Records, besides, you know, working with all these amazing bands and connecting with all these amazing people all over the world, to me it was like a college master's degree education in marketing and branding and in all these different aspects of life, career, whatever. But I didn't know at the time. Like, so what happened for me was everything I did for SFT Records, like the way it would work was like I would come up with something, and sometimes a band would have great ideas too, but a lot of the stuff for the ads, what's on the record, the concepts of the merchandise, whatever, I would just work with my girl, and I'd come up with names, you know, taglines for stuff and ad concepts and packaging concepts and whatever. And then she was an incredible designer. She could bring my pencil scratch vision to like a polished outcome. So everything from creative, branding, public relations, manufacturing, financial, like all that stuff had to be handled by me. So what I learned just from that is literally DIY. I learned how every aspect of all the different pipelines and merchandising and production, audio, video, how all that stuff works, what it really costs, what you should be paying, you know, who's just gacking you on the price, and the attention to detail that you're the final set of eyes. You approve everything. You know what I mean? Because then you know it's not wrong. And all that stuff, then brand identity. Like when I got to Rockstar, and then they would say like, oh, what is your brand identity for this product? And I'd be like, oh, this is like when I would say like no redeeming social value, like whatever their hype copy was, like no redeeming social value is doing this, or Vision of Disorder, or 25 to Life. What was it? Like the something like the hardcore spirit of Agnostic Front collides with something, you know what I mean? But just like branding statements, positioning statements, kind of who you are in the market, what differentiates you from the others, what are you going to build your branding and messaging on and about? These were all things that I was doing just by figuring out myself, like by saying, huh, our merch has to be cooler than the other guy's merch. You know, like these are all things you're figuring out. Like, what is our brand? What does our brand mean? Like, I wanted Striving for Togetherness to mean it doesn't matter if you know who the band is. You know that if it's on our label, it's going to have dope packaging. It's going to sound dope. And the band is going to be the bomb, whether they're a straight edge band, metal style band, a rap group, whatever it is. They're going to be killer because they meet our standard. You know what I mean? That was kind of the goal. So going into video games, all the things that I was doing was now every part of my job at Rockstar Games. You know what I mean? And it was all because I knew how to do it. You know what I mean? And if I didn't know how to do it, there was no one else. Do you know what I mean? So it's just kind of like, all right, what's your brand positioning statement? What's your tagline? What's your packaging going to be? What's the TV commercial concept? How are you going to sell it to retail? Like, what's their tagline? What materials are retailers going to get? How are you going to sell it directly to consumers? I would have to not just come up with the, oh, we're going to do these things, but like I would have to literally write the tagline that's on the back of the box, capture the screenshots that were the screenshots that match the features that we're trying to push, directing the recording sessions to capture the gameplay that goes in the trailer that's pushing the most magical split seconds that actually differentiate the game from its competitors. And sometimes if you're working on a bad game, that can be incredibly taxing.
So during your tenure at Rockstar, was that with the original Grand Theft Auto?
Yeah, I was there. Grand Theft Auto 1 had just come out on PlayStation, but it wasn't. Rockstar didn't even exist when Grand Theft Auto 1 came out.
Was it Take-Two Interactive on that?
Yeah, Take-Two Interactive, and then ASC Games did the PC version. But literally right after it came out, a few months later, the ball started rolling for Rockstar. Like, I started working at Rockstar. It didn't have a name yet. It was just the Rockstar guys, but they didn't know what it was going to be called yet. And then like 3 or 4 months after I started, the name they came up with was Rockstar Games. And what, like I said, what's incredible about it, so when I got that job, it was like a dream job, and I had been doing the label for a long time. We had 19 releases, and I was a big student of Rick Rubin and Russell Simmons and also Ian MacKay, as far as being influenced and inspired, and ICP on how they all did stuff. So I just felt like, man, if we're making this much noise and selling this many records and we're just funding it all ourselves and doing it by the skin of our teeth, surely we're going to get some kind of a cool deal to be able to do this on a bigger level, to become a subsidiary somewhere, to become a label, you know, put your label next to our label name on the back, like a P&D deal, whatever, that would allow this shit to become even bigger. But it was just getting frustrating. And then other labels were all swooping in and signing all the bands and everything. And it's like, oh, this sucks. So I got this incredible opportunity at Rockstar, and I was like, oh, man, this is incredible. Now it's no longer just me. It's like I'm on this team. I don't got to worry about every little detail of everything. No more working crazy hours or, you know, just at all times. But then that was the part that wasn't true. Like, even though there was people on the team, everyone's kind of heading up their own ship. So you are – there's people you can reach out to, but you are very much the captain of your own ship and left to your own devices, sink or swim. So – and the working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that was 100% legit too. You know what I mean? And having to be on every detail of everything was your responsibility, like literally. And there's so many details and rules with console packaging and language and the ratings boards and all this stuff. It's like it's a tightrope. And so basically everything I knew learned from SFT Records was – every part of being a brand manager for Rockstar Games, which to me was like, wow, this is incredible. Like now I validated kind of the last 6 years of my life doing this label by now doing a couple of years stint here and then an even longer one at Eidos just because the hours were much more chill. Sorry for the like dropping Bible verse length War and Peace style answers, but you guys got me reflecting over here.
That is okay. So you've basically had the coolest career path like I can imagine, like going from DIY punk dude to making the coolest video games. It's really interesting shit, and I'm glad that you're sharing it with us.
100%. And we had an earlier game that I had licensed a bunch of New York hardcore for, and at the last minute, the Rockstar guys kind of got weird about stuff, and suddenly they didn't want the hardcore music in the game, the music that they specifically were like, get some great hardcore music. But then it's funny because then after I left, they used all those same bands and a bunch of my other friends to do an all hardcore station in Grand Theft Auto.
Liberty City Hardcore, yeah.
Yeah, man. Obviously, they didn't call me to do any of the DJ drops or whatever, but I feel like I'm a huge reason or you know what I mean? Or at least I have like a tiny in between a footnote and a credit for that whole thing happening, because it was literally through friends of mine that they put it all together with and people they wouldn't have known. You know what I'm saying? If it wasn't for me.
Yeah.
But there was that one. And then there was one other one, too. Oh, the one thing I brought to the world of Rockstar Games was my love of ICP. We would listen to ICP in the office. We would watch ICP videos, Stranglemania, all that shit. I would sit with Sam Hauser and Dan Hauser, the masterminds of, you know, Grand Theft Auto and Rockstar Games and all that, and other guys that aren't there anymore. And we would watch all this stuff endlessly, fascinated and laughing and loving it. And then a few years later, they release Grand Theft Auto with a mock-up character. Oh, you know, that character in the game, I forget his name, but he basically has Shaggy Two Dope's exact hairstyle and face paint. And they used it for billboard advertising and stuff, too, as like a key image for the game.
Yeah, yeah. For I guess that was for GTA 5. I don't know. I've played every one of those games. I love that shit.
But I mean, the games are revolutionary, man.
And
I knew that from the moment I saw Grand Theft Auto 1. It was through my connect, like my love of Grand Theft Auto 1 and a chance meeting with someone that led to me working there. But I was already on Grand Theft Auto at the 1 stage, which not many people were. Most everyone came on board for 3, you know?
Yeah, I guess I don't know a whole lot about how much it goes into making a video game, but I have to assume that there's a much smaller staff involved in the top down video game versus the fully 3D environment.
Yes, but the top down one, the world is so big. Just making worlds of that size, there was a reason it wasn't really done, because one, it's a Herculean effort, and then two, you have to bug test that. You have to be able to fix problems with it. And when the world is that large and with that many ways of different interactions and whatever, you open yourself up to a huge, huge, huge technical hurdle in just being able to get it cleared from a bug perspective, to get it through and approved.
Yeah, I totally believe you.
I swear to God.
No, I'm trying to think about like every little interaction that could possibly happen with all of these little different frames. It seems mind-boggling.
Yeah, it's just crazy. There's a team over in Scotland, DMA Design. Like, they're the guys that made Grand Theft Auto, period. Like, and then Sam Houser and the other guys who form Rockstar, they basically worked at the publishing company. BMG, back in the day, used to make their own video games. So BMG, the, you know, Bertelsmann Group, they had a studio called DMA in Scotland making this game for them, which originally had a different name. And then BMG Publishing in the UK was headed up by Sam Houser, who founded Rockstar Games. So Sam basically just got to work in that on that project, like to bring it to the UK market or to have it go from the UK to the world or however it was arranged. So then he got kind of in on the product, so to speak, at that time. So then he's like, oh, we'll bring this over to Rockstar Games and et cetera. And then and DMA have been on it ever since.
So what's
but
next?
That, they changed their name to Rockstar North. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So what's next on your massive plate of things to do?
Well, next on my list of things to do is I just recorded a voiceover for a commercial that's going to air in a bunch of major markets for a new Danny Diablo record on Force 5 Records, the nice. Cracks and Heights project. So shout out to Danny Diablo and Force 5 Records for that gig. And I got a bunch of live shows coming up. I'll be doing commentary for All Pro Wrestling here in California. Actually, this coming weekend. Details at allprowrestling.com. Jack Swagger, the Reno Scum, many more in action. And you can always keep up on all my dates on my Facebook and Twitter. I got shows coming up for Pro Wrestling Revolution. All Pro Wrestling is going to be back at the Cow Palace in San Francisco with Rey Mysterio and Juventud Guerrera taking on Pentagon, or Penta Zero M as he's known now, and Rey Fénix. And then let's see, I'm going to be announcing some new stuff that I'm working on really, really soon, which I'm really excited about, kind of a new medium, a new platform, if you will, but I'm not abandoning any of my other current platforms. It's just a new way to reach people. I'm on Twitter at OG Kevin Gill and at Kevin Gill Show. Also on Instagram at OG Kevin Gill. There's a Facebook like page, KG Kevin Gill. And dignifiedbastard.com is a place where you can pick up a lot of classic SFT records reissues, as well as Kevin Gill Show merch, stickers, you know, PMA, pins and memorabilia. It's a great way to just support what I'm doing. Ditto for the Patreon page, patreon.com/Kevin Gill Show. Like everybody else, I have a Patreon or whatever. I have a Pro Wrestling Tees store. And most interestingly, I have a High Spots Wrestling Network discount code. HighSpotsWrestlingNetwork.com is the place you can watch my new video series, But I Digress. Episode 1 is there now featuring Johnny Mundo. It's also got all your favorite wrestling from Pro Wrestling Guerrilla, CZW, a lot of cool Young Bucks content, Kevin Owens, on and on. You get your first month for 50% off. That's only $4.99. Cancel anytime, no obligation. Just use the code PMA, and they'll hook up your boy KG for hooking you up with a half-price deal at HighSpotsWrestlingNetwork.com. And check out District 9, man. District 9, one of my favorite bands in SFT history, along with Vision of Disorder. Both of their reissues are available from DignifiedBastard.com, but they're also available digitally remastered and et cetera on iTunes. And I'm real excited about that shit. And hopefully, yeah. Oh, and I'm going to be in Brooklyn. Sorry, last one. I'm going to be in Brooklyn, New York on October 23rd for Insane Clown Posse making their Williamsburg debut at Villain. So I invite everyone to come out and see the Great Malenko performed live. And I think it's going to blow your minds, and I think it's going to sell out. So get tickets now. And much love to you guys for having me on. Sorry for talking your heads off, but you got me all in the feels.
Kevin, thanks so much for doing this. And absolutely, you guys, if you're in Brooklyn, and especially if you've never seen ICP, go to this show. It's going to be a good one.
Good times ahead. And listen to the Kevin Gill Show. It's available wherever podcasts are heard, Audio Boom, iTunes, Stitcher, all that stuff. This week we got Keith Lee on there, who's an amazing breakout performer. Next week we start a two-part series with Gangrel And then we got interviews coming up with Lou from Sick of It All, as well as our homie from Killswitch Engage.
Very cool.
Awesome. And everyone go check out Stranglemania on YouTube. You'll laugh your ass off.
Yeah, you got to see it. That's what got me into ICP, man. Stranglemania. Look at the fucking photographers. They're loving it. That's your brother, Deadly Fred.
Cactus Sack.
Lama Nama knew me.
Kevin, thank you so much for doing this show.
Thank you guys, man. I had a blast. Thank you so much. Whoop, whoop.
I know y'all ain't in, but I just want to let y'all know something, man. Y'all know I love you. Y'all know you're my homies. And, all right, we'll talk later. Peace.
Ask you this about this life we live, and let me try to swerve some of this attention you give to them distant ass relatives over Hampton. And if they really missed you so much, why don't they just call and talk? If you wasn't blood, would you still have love? Or in fact, does the blood make you think you have to love? Look, I probably love my family more than anybody here, but my homies are family too. Third cousins, get out of here. Who was you with when you got tattooed? And who was you tripping with when you did them mushrooms? And who the fuck threw up all over your car and then felt worse than you about the shit in the morning?
Who loans your money, homie? Who owes your cash? Oh, who taught you how to use the bomb for the grass? Oh, I don't know much, but I gotta assume that when you hit your first net, your homies was in.
You talk about homies.
Like, I don't know, maybe dishwashing or fucking flipping fries. And you got this boss who think he the Don Mega because he the head manager, cheap chili fry maker. All you can vision is y'all beating him down, your homie standing on his back while you're kicking his head around. But responsibility is there, I can't lie, though I'd have been plucked his fucking eyeball out with a chicken bone. I'm crazy as fuck, I'll rip your piercings off, and now my homies are holding me back so I don't look soft.
When you snuck the car out, who did you get it? And when you got color, who'd you blame the shit? Can you relax the mind and scratch your balls? Oh, homies, I'm talking about like you and yours.
And if you step to one of us, you better step to the whole crew. Yeah. I never knew that I could depend, that I can have some friends. It's down to the very end. Well, that's my homeboys, excuse me, my family. And when we conquer the world, we macking on the galaxy. Cause sky's the limit and we ain't finishing. If my homies gon' ride, then you know I'm with it.
Puff it and pass it and I give it to my homies, y'all. Hit it and quit it, then I give it to my homies, y'all. I got the world around my finger with my homies, y'all. And everything is obsolete unless I hear my homies call. We worldwide, we're homies across the planet, sticking together like zippers on a Michael Jackson Peter Jackson. They got my back like a tap for that, I love y'all. Hanging till we old and gray like grandpa.
Homies, homies.
Keeping your click up the house, you know, like baby. Fuck off. Running with your homie, tell
listening to 66.6 FM. Radio TOVH. The Flush.